This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So before we begin, I would like to dedicate this learning to the memory of my father, whose yahrzeit, meaning the anniversary of his death in Hebrew, is tonight and tomorrow, the 30th of Nisan. As someone said at his funeral, my father passed away between Yom HaShoah and Yom HaAtzmaut, and that actually tells some of the story of his life. He was born in Poland, in Galicia, in the town of Brody, and he and my mother managed to escape to the Soviet Union. They took all of their siblings except one. They were engaged to be married at the time. And my father led the group as they went without any money, without any home, and not knowing the Russian language, and managed to survive in the Soviet Union for 4 years until they made their way back to their hometown. My father was a member of HaShomer HaTzair, as was my mother, a left-wing Zionist organization. He and my mother came from religious homes. They moved away from religious observance, as many young Polish Jews did in the early 20th century. They dreamed of making Aliyah. Instead, they came to the United States in 1946 and only made Aliyah in 1996, 50 years later. So I know that he would be very happy to know that I was teaching this subject, as both issues were very close to his heart. Yehi Zichro Baruch, may his memory be for a blessing. Okay. If I ask you, what is the connection between the Shoah and the creation of the State of Israel? Tell me the simple answer. It was a catalyst. Okay, anybody else? Jews need a place to be safe. Anybody else? Redeeming factor of the Shoah is it led to the creation of the State of Israel. Seth? Okay. Guilt or world sympathy from the Shoah led to the creation of the State of Israel. Anybody else? Okay, I think we more or less covered the simple version. There is some truth to what everybody said. The exception I would take is the redeeming factor of the Shoah is the creation of the State of Israel. I would not associate myself with that statement. I don't think anything makes up for the Shoah. But there is some connection, but the connections are a little more complex than the oversimplified versions that most people usually use, the cliches that most people usually use. Now, this is reinforced. These simplistic formulas are reinforced by the fact that in Israel, for example, Yom HaShoah comes out a week before Yom HaAtzmaut. Did anybody know why Yom HaShoah comes out on the 27th of Nisan? Almost. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising began on April 19th, 1943. Which was Erev Pesach. It would be difficult to have Yom HaShoah on Erev Pesach in a Jewish state. But the leaders of the country in the early 1950s, when Yom HaShoah was established, were very intent that it should take place at some point during the period of the revolt, because the revolt lasted into May. It lasted a little more than a month. To them, that was very important. In fact, the name itself is not Yom HaShoah. What's the name of that day that we just commemorated yesterday? Right. Yom HaZikaron LaShoah VeLigvura. Right. The Memorial Day for the Holocaust and Gvura. Gvura meaning courage, meaning resistance, right? That was a very, very important theme for Israelis and, by the way, for young American Jews in the 1950s and 60s. The idea of resistance was very, very important to them. I think over the decades it's become a little bit, it's been put a little bit more in perspective, and we appreciate other aspects of the martyrdom of Jews and not only those who fought. But in any case, that's why it's at this time of year. By the way, former Prime Minister Menachem Begin actually objected to the dating, putting this as a date on the 27th of Nisan. He wanted Yom HaShoah to be observed on Tisha B'Av. He wanted to make Tisha B'Av Yom HaShoah, but he led a minority party at the time, and so that idea never flew. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to start with an excerpt from a speech by President Barack Obama. As many of you may remember, President Barack Obama, early on in his presidency, visited Cairo. And spoke at the university there. One of the things that I've always admired about President Obama is that, unlike most political leaders, he actually at times said things to audiences they didn't necessarily want to hear. He did that on a number of occasions that I know of. It's very unusual for political leaders to do that. Usually they just pander to whatever the audience wants to hear. He did the opposite on a number of occasions that I know of, I'm sure more. And this is one of those cases. So, everybody has one? America's strong bonds with Israel are well known. This is speaking at Cairo University. You all know we have a peace treaty with Egypt, but there is a lot of strong anti-Israel sentiment in Egypt, as in much of the Arab world. This bond is unbreakable. It is based upon cultural and historical ties and the recognition of the aspiration for a Jewish homeland is rooted in a tragic history that cannot be denied. Around the world, the Jewish people were persecuted for centuries, and anti-Semitism in Europe culminated in an unprecedented Holocaust. By the way, Holocaust denial is extremely popular in the Arab world. What makes news is when an Arab leader actually acknowledges that the Holocaust took place. That makes news. And here, President Obama is telling them what they don't want to hear. Tomorrow, I'll visit Buchenwald, which was part of a network of camps where Jews were enslaved, tortured, shot, and gassed to death by the Third Reich. 6 million Jews were killed, more than the entire population of Israel today. Denying that fact is baseless, ignorant, and hateful. Threatening Israel with destruction or repeating vile stereotypes about Jews is deeply wrong and only serves to evoke in the minds of Israelis this most painful of memories while preventing the peace that the people of this region deserve. It's interesting that after President Obama made this speech, and this is obviously not the entire speech, but this excerpt in particular, there was a lot of criticism of him from Israel. Because essentially, what President Obama is saying, and really I admire his courage saying this to the audience that he said it to, is that the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel, and the state of Israel, is connected to a tragic history that cannot be denied. And when you say cannot be denied, he's almost foreshadowing what he's going to talk about, which is the Shoah. In other words, he's making this connection as well in a very simplistic way, although, again, I admire his courage in what he said. As we know, truth is usually more complex than that and more nuanced. And while there are connections, I'll come to you in a minute, Mish, and we'll discuss them later in the session, the fact is this is a simplistic and linear view. Mish, Absolutely, yes. That's another example, is that foreign dignitaries in general, when they come to Israel, are taken first to Yad Vashem, which is just another reinforcing of this idea. And again, I don't mean to deny that there are connections, but as we'll see, the connections are not as simple and linear as we might think. So first of all, I want to go back a little bit in history and say that the creation of the State of Israel is something that actually has very, very deep roots in Jewish history. For example, the Bible. If you look in the book of Genesis and Sefer Bereishit, the land is promised to our forefathers and to all of their descendants. And even though that's not a claim on the land, it may not be a valid claim on the land, it's part of our narrative. It's part of what we understand. It's part of our self-image. And that connection goes through our understanding, again, our narrative. I don't want to say it's historical fact because it can't be proven, at least at this point, about the exodus from Egypt, which ends up ultimately after 40 years in the land of Israel. The building of the first temple, the kings, Saul and David and Solomon and all of those who follow, the destruction of the first temple, and when the exiles went to Babel, we have in the book of Psalms a record of what they said, which was, Sham yashavnu gam bachinu bezochreinu at Zion. There we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. Who was it? Don McLean who did that song, who used that words and very beautifully in a song. In other words, that connection to Zion was not lost when they went into exile. And there was the return to Zion under Ezra and Nehemiah and the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in this land. And after the destruction of the Second Temple, Jews continued to face Jerusalem wherever they were when they prayed. And they continued to pray for the return to Jerusalem, for the return to Jewish sovereignty to this land. So, for example, at what are arguably the two highest points of the Jewish year, Yom Kippur and Leil HaSeder, at the end of Ne'ilah, the last thing we say is, what? Next year in Jerusalem, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. And Jews have been doing that for many centuries. And the same thing at Leil HaSeder. You know, all of those songs at the end, Echad Miyodea, Echad Gadya, etc., those are like later additions. Actually, the Seder ends, technically, with the words, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. So the creation of the modern state of Israel is something that goes back very, very deep in Jewish history and is not something that's some kind of 20th century invention. But I want to, and here we'll go to the slides, but I want to talk about what was happening in the land of Israel and among the Jewish people in the more recent past. There was, by 1939, meaning by the beginning of World War II, there was already a state in the making. It's not like the Holocaust happened, and then all of a sudden, the world decided, you know what, there should be a Jewish state, they need it. Organizationally, the grassroots Chibat Zion movement, the Lovers of Zion movement, began around 1880, in Russia. The first Aliyah began in 1881. And Theodor Herzl, who founds the World Zionist Organization, he actually only founded 15 or 16 years after the first Aliyah. In other words, he's really not the founder of modern Zionism. He's the founder of political Zionism. But the idea of returning to the land and establishing the Jewish presence here, re-establishing the Jewish presence here. There were Jews living here, but the idea of bringing together the Jews from the four corners of the earth, reviving the Hebrew language, all of those things predate Herzl. Herzl's chidush, right, what he brings to the table is, first of all, his emphasis on political Zionism, meaning statehood, to be achieved politically, meaning by diplomacy, hence political Zionism. And also organizationally, the founding of the World Zionist Organization. But we shouldn't think that he created something ex nihilo. Not only was there traditional Zionism that we've just been talking about going back to the Bible, but modern Zionism really predates him as well. A state in the making by 1939. By 1939, it had been five waves of Jewish immigration, beginning in 1881. So that in 1881, there are 25,000 Jews living in Palestine, which is then ruled by the Ottoman Turks. By 1942, there were 400,000, an increase of 16 times in 60 years. It's a very young, vibrant, and idealistic community. 85% of them are under the age of 45. A state in the making in agriculture as well. Jews return to the land, to the soil. Something that hardly existed in 1881. By 1939, there are about 150 agricultural settlements. A full one-quarter of the Jews are living on the land, and the most successful agricultural communal life experiment in modern times has been created, the kibbutz. The cities also grew tremendously in terms of their Jewish population. Tel Aviv, which was only founded in 1909, had 150,000 Jews in 1939. Jerusalem had 16,000 Jews in 1881. By the way, that was a majority of the population of the city in 1881. By 1939, it was 90,000. Haifa had less than 1,000 Jews in 1881. Now it had 60,000. But it was a state in the making also in terms of cultural developments, the revival of the Hebrew language. Hebrew daily newspapers begin to appear in the early 1900s. Hebrew theater, universities teaching in Hebrew. And by the way, that was not to be taken for granted. The first university founded in the Middle East. Anybody know which one it was? It was founded in 1912, I believe. The Technion in Haifa. Supported by well-to-do German Jews. The language of instruction was German. German was, after all, the language of the sciences in those days. It was the English of those days when it came to scientific research. And so the well-to-do German Jews who were among the most important backers, it was very natural that it should be in German. There was a strike called in the Yishuv, in the Jewish community in Palestine, which insisted that the Technion should change its language of instruction to Hebrew, which they did eventually. And when the second university was founded in the 1920s, the early 20s, in Jerusalem, they called it the Hebrew University. In other words, make no mistake about what language we're going to use. So this ancient language, which was used by the rabbis and used by people in prayer, all of a sudden becomes not only the language of daily newspapers and of theater, but also becomes the language of academic research. A state in the making also creates its own military. There are three underground militias by 1939, the Haganah, the Etzel, and the Lehi. A state in the making by 1939 because in 1917, the Zionist movement was able to get the most powerful empire in the world, the British Empire, to support the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. And in 1920, the San Remo Agreement, it was part of the Treaty of Versailles, endorsed that idea. And in 1922, the League of Nations granted Britain the mandate over Palestine. And here I want you to turn. First of all, there's a page that I skipped, Jewish Settlements in Palestine, 1855 to 1914. This doesn't include... Yeah, okay. And then turn the page to Britain and the Jewish National Home. You could see the Balfour Declaration in the box in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. Right? His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment of Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by the Jews in any other country. Does the second half undo the first half? Why doesn't the second half, protecting the civil and religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine, why doesn't that undo the first half? Here it's talking about non-Jews. Yes, that's true. Absolutely. Absolutely. The political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country, absolutely. Zionism was not universal among the Jewish people. It never was in the modern period. But I'm talking about the civil and religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine. Doesn't that seem to undo the idea of a national home for the Jewish people? Yeah. Good. Okay. So basically what it's saying is, as a national home, it'll be the national home for the Jewish people. However, within that national home, the civil and religious rights of non-Jews need to be protected and need to be respected. Okay? And here you see the map of Palestine as it was given to the British in the Mandate. And you can see that it includes both Israel today, including the occupied territories, Judea, Samaria, etc., the Golan Heights. And if you look to the right of the Jordan River, it includes what is today the Kingdom of Jordan. And that eventually is the British are going to give over to the Emir Abdullah in 1921, and that'll be closed to Jewish settlement. Let's take a look at the next document, the British Mandate. Okay, this is the League of Nations on July 24th, 1922. Right, the Council of the League of Nations. It's a lot of legalese here, so I'll be skipping. Look at the second full paragraph. Whereas the principal allied powers have also agreed the mandatory should be responsible for putting into effect the declaration originally made on November 2, 1917 by the government of His Britannic Majesty and adopted by the said powers in favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. By the way, you note that in the Balfour Declaration as well as here, national home for the Jewish people could mean a state, but doesn't have to mean a state. It's vaguely worded. A national home for the Jewish people, it could mean a state, doesn't have to mean a state. Winston Churchill, who was a member of the cabinet, said our intention was a state, but having said that, the words themselves are open to interpretation. Basically, what's happening here is that the League of Nations is saying, Britain, you have control of Palestine, but the purpose of your control of Palestine is to implement the Balfour Declaration. And then it goes on in the next paragraph, whereas recognition has thereby been given to the historical connection of the Jewish people with Palestine, to the grounds for reconstituting the national home in that country, etc. If you look at Article 2 on the right-hand side, the mandatory shall be responsible for the placing of the country under such political, administrative, and economic conditions as will secure the establishment of the Jewish national home, as laid down in the preamble, and the development of self-governing institutions, and also for safeguarding the civil and religious rights of all the inhabitants of Palestine, irrespective of race and religion. Again, civil and religious rights, not national rights. And Article 4, an appropriate Jewish agency shall be recognized as a public body, and this is where the Zionist organization becomes that appropriate Jewish agency. So, diplomatically, well before World War II, there is a state in the making. It's already happening. It's happening both in terms of people, it's happening in terms of international agreements. And this is all, of course, well before World War II begins. Questions up to this point? Sure, Tali. Now, I want to add one more thing about the state in the making, and that is that something that I just read yesterday that I had never thought about is that the creation of the State of Israel is actually very much a part of the larger colonial retreat of Britain and France especially. in the late 1940s. And the best example of this is 1947, the creation of India and Pakistan. India and Pakistan were created as part of the dissolution of the British Empire, and there was no Holocaust for the Indians and for the Pakistanis. There's no question there was a good deal of violence, and that's one of the reasons why India was split between a more Hindu India and a more Muslim Pakistan, and there were actually forcible population transfers. There was much violence, you're right. But what I'm saying is it didn't take a Holocaust for the British to retreat and for national states to be created in what was once were colonial areas. It's, in other words, the creation of the State of Israel should also be viewed from the perspective of the retreat of the colonial powers and the granting of independence to, if you like, third world peoples. So I guess what I'm trying to say is there was a Jewish state on the way without the Shoah. Yes. Is there a simplistic way of explaining it? Do you want the simplistic way or do you want the more complex way? Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, we don't have time to go through all of that, but I think that in general, modern Zionism develops out of many things. It first of all develops out of that traditional Zionism, the traditional connection of the Jews to the land of Israel, even when most of the Jews were living far from it. It develops out of 19th century nationalism, which infects the Jews as well. It develops out of anti-Semitism in 19th century Europe and the disappointment with emancipation. Yes. Ah, okay. So, okay, it's a very good question. And the answer is really the answer that I want to come to about that I think really complicates the issue of world sympathy, and that is national interests. More than anything else, national policies are made according to what are perceived to be national interests. That is where national leaders make their decisions, not out of sympathy. All you have to do is ask the people in Syria. There's lots of sympathy out there, but national policies are made out of national interest. And tragically, for the people of Syria, like the people of Darfur, like the people of Rwanda before them, national interests did not work in their favor. And therefore, all of the sympathy in the world is not enough to help them. And that's going to be the case in the creation of the State of Israel as well. Sympathy can help a little bit. It's nice when the two dovetail, but in the end, it's going to be national interest that's going to determine policy. Okay? Okay. So all of these things were that I said about the state in the making actually come to a pretty abrupt halt in the 1930s. And here, the rise of Hitler and Nazism actually works against the creation of a Jewish state. Because in the 1930s, after the Nazis come to power in Germany in 1933, the Nazis in Germany, the fascists in Italy, begin to cultivate the peoples of the Middle East in order to get their support for the coming war against Britain. And the British are very aware of this. And so, for example, the Italians establish radio stations on their eastern coast to broadcast in Arabic. And the Nazis establish all sorts of cultural missions to the Middle East in order to cultivate the support of the peoples of the Middle East, primarily the Arabs, for what they perceive to be their coming war against what they assume will be their common enemy. After all, if the British and the French are the largest colonial powers in the Middle East, and the Germans are planning to make war against Britain and France, they assume they'll have a common enemy together with the Arabs of the Middle East. And so, for example, the leader of Palestinian nationalism, in the 1930s and 40s. Haj Amin al-Husseini is a guest in Berlin of Hitler and receives letters of support for the Palestinian nationalist cause. In 1936, the Arabs in Palestine begin what's called the Arab Revolt in 1936. You might actually call it the First Intifada. It lasts for 3 years. It's in response to the massive Fifth Aliyah, the Aliyah of about 90,000 German Jews who were fleeing from Hitler. And that is something that for the Palestinian nationalists threatened their own hold on the land, and therefore they start a revolt called the Arab Revolt. The British suppress this revolt brutally, but it lasts for 3 long years. And the British, if you remember your European history, are worried not only about Palestine. They're worried about Nazi Germany, as by 1936 they are rearming. By 1938 they will unify with Austria. They've already broken the Treaty of Versailles. They will break their pledge of Munich and will invade Czechoslovakia in 1938. In early 1939. And so with war coming, the British are desperate to keep the support, or at least keep neutral, the Arabs of the Middle East. And why is that so important to the British?
Oil.
Oil. In 1912, the British Navy went over from coal to oil. From that point on, you cannot fight a modern war without oil. If you read the military histories of World War II, you will see that many of them maintain that the war was won by the Allies in large part because they were able to deny the Axis powers supplies of oil. By the end of the war, the Germans are rationing how many sorties their air force can fly, how far their tanks can go, because they have so little oil left. And this is one of the reasons why the Allies defeated the Axis in World War II. It was, in fact, the American oil embargo on Japan that triggered the attack on Pearl Harbor. Because the Japanese, who had imperialistic ambitions, knew they could not fight wars without oil. So oil is a critical ingredient for any modern war. And here, the Axis and the Allies are going to be competing for oil. And if the various Arab peoples of the Middle East are going to be anti-British, the British are going to have a very hard time flying their planes, moving their tanks, and moving their ships. In the wake of this Arab revolt that the British are suppressing brutally, in 1939, the British called together a series of roundtable talks. They tried to bring the Jewish and Arab sides together in Palestine. They fail. And so they issue what's called the British White Paper of 1939. And the British White Paper of 1939 essentially said the following. One, Jews are not allowed to buy any more land in Palestine. Two, the number of Jewish immigrants is going to be severely limited. Three, in 10 years, Palestine will become independent. And that would mean Palestine will become independent with an Arab majority. Because there were about, now I'm talking about 1948 numbers, so it's probably a little less than this, there were about 1 million Arabs living in Palestine and about 650,000 Jews living in Palestine in 1948. So going back 9 years, those numbers are a little bit less, but the proportions are probably not so different. Essentially, the British took a very big step back from the Balfour Declaration. And they did so, and a very big step back from the idea of a state in the making. And the reason they did so was they were about to fight a war, and they couldn't afford to have the Arab world against them. Okay. So, in that sense, the rise of Nazism and the approach of World War II sets back the creation of the State of Israel. Moreover, the Shoah dealt a terrible blow to the Zionist movement. The majority of the victims of the Shoah were from Eastern Europe, where the Zionist movement was strongest. In places like Poland and Lithuania, 90% of the Jews were murdered. This was the heart of the Zionist movement. The American Jewish community, just to quote one example, was not very Zionistic traditionally. The strongest Zionist movements were in Eastern Europe, and those were the ones that were either wiped out or almost wiped out. And that meant the largest potential reserves of Aliyah were now gone. And here I want to share something with you that is very hard to say and might be hard to hear. Sometimes I believe the Nazis won. They destroyed 2/3 of European Jewry. European Jewry was the leadership of world Jewry at the time. They destroyed a whole way of life. They destroyed whole cultures that we don't have anymore. Jewish communities in Germany, in Poland, in Lithuania, in Hungary. Think of the great Jewish thinkers of the 20th century. Martin Buber, Franz Rosenzweig. In America, Abraham Joshua Heschel, Rav Soloveitchik, and in Israel, Rav Kook. They're all from Central and Eastern Europe. Even if they lived in America, or even if they lived in Israel, they were all products of Central and East European Jewish culture. I think only Mordechai Kaplan would be the only great 20th century American-born Jewish thinker. And the same thing was true for the Zionist movement. The greatest leaders of the Zionist movement were all from Eastern and Central Europe. Herzl, Achad HaAm, Chaim Weizmann, who's the first president, Ben-Gurion. So we can't even calculate the damage done to the Zionist movement by the Shoah and how far it set the Zionist movement back. And I'll repeat what I said before. I don't think that the creation of the State of Israel in any way makes up for the losses that the Jewish people suffered in the Shoah. It may be a very good thing to have a Jewish state, a place of refuge, a place to build a modern Hebrew culture, a place to try to implement Jewish ideals, but that can't make up for what we suffered in the Shoah, and the two should not be conflated as if one makes up for the other. It is true that the Shoah created sympathy for the Zionist cause. By the way, not only the Shoah, but in the year following World War II, the 18 months following World War II, about 1,000 Jews were murdered in Poland in pogroms by their neighbors. That's about 1,000 survivors. And those were in the world headlines as well. And so that does generate sympathy for the Zionist cause. But as I said before, sympathy is fine and good, but without national interests, it doesn't get you very far. It doesn't mean world opinion is worthless. But most political and economic decisions are not based on sympathy. They're based on self-interest. One example of that is in the creation of the State of Israel. The two major world powers after World War II are the Soviet Union and the United States. I think especially for young people today, it's hard to imagine what a superpower the Soviet Union was. But remember that the Nazis were defeated largely not by the Allies in the West. They were defeated largely not at Normandy. They were defeated at Stalingrad. That was the biggest battle of World War II. That's where millions and millions of soldiers died on both sides. It was the Red Army that swept back across Europe and conquered Berlin. And June 1944 was already towards the end of the war when the Allies landed in Normandy. The Russians were already defeating the Germans and had already started to not only reconquer all of Russia that was lost, but they already started to conquer parts of Poland from Germany. And the Germans were already in retreat when the Normandy invasion happened in June 1944. The Soviet Union, as a with its communist ideology, believed that Zionism was bourgeois nationalism. Lenin, Trotsky, whose real name was Lev Bronstein, and all of the great communist leaders rail against Zionism. So how is it that in 1947, when it comes up for a vote in the United Nations, the Soviet Union and all of their satellite states all vote for partition? Is it out of sympathy for the Jewish people? I think that's naive. They had one interest: getting the British out of the Middle East. And if partition meant getting the British out of the Middle East, they would support that too. But now I want to come to the United States, where I think there's a confluence of sympathy and interest, in particular about the behavior of the United States president at the time, Harry Truman. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was perhaps the greatest of all American presidents. He certainly was the longest serving. He won his elections by landslide victories. He served four terms. After Roosevelt, there had to be a constitutional amendment limiting a president to two elected terms. Roosevelt was immensely popular. His illness was hidden from the press and from the public. In those days, you could do such things. It was an age of far less transparency than we have today. When he died, World War II was still going on. And America found that its demigod, its fearless leader, its most popular president in its history, was no longer alive to lead them. Who was to take over? A vice president who was vice president for his first term, had only served as vice president for less than a year, a senator from Missouri who was largely unknown in America, named Harry Truman. Harry Truman steps into a tremendous political vacuum. It happens to be that many historians believe he was one of the great presidents of the United States, but at that time, he was a nobody, stepping into shoes that were just enormous. He had a problem of legitimacy. He was not elected president. He was not elected leader of the Democratic Party. By happenstance, he becomes president. Now, at the same time in America, the American Jewish community has become a pro-Zionist community, something it had never been before the rise of Nazism. Before 1933, much of the Orthodox community, most of the Reform community, and large sections of the American Jewish community at large were not necessarily Zionists. But from 1933 to 1945, in 12 years, Membership in U.S. Zionist organizations quadrupled. Quadrupled in 12 years. Because the Zionist axiom that Jews might never be safe in the diaspora seemed to be proven true. U.S. Jewish organizations raised between 1945 and 1948 $100 million for the displaced persons and for the Jewish yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine. Now, $100 million, I'm talking about $100 million 1940s dollars. When my parents came to America in 1946, my mother said, everything cost a nickel. To ride on the subway, 5 cents. A quart of milk, 5 cents. A loaf of bread, 5 cents. The Jewish community in the 1940s was not as well-to-do as the Jewish community today. And yet they raised $100 million 1940s dollars. I can't tell you how many trillions of dollars that would translate into today. The American Jewish community was galvanized. And there was deep caring, both for the DPs and for the yeshuv, the Jewish community in Palestine. At the same time, these American Jews constituted not 2% of the population as they do today. They constituted almost 5% of the American Jewish population, of American total population. And they were concentrated in the most important electoral states. And of course, they voted disproportionately to their numbers compared to the rest of the American population. And so on Yom Kippur, I'm sorry, Erev Yom Kippur, 1946, President Harry Truman delivers the typical annual Yom Kippur message to American Jewry. I'm sure that on Columbus Day, they do the same for the Italian Americans. On St. Patrick's Day, they do the same for the Irish Americans. Today, on Martin Luther King Day, they do so for the African Americans. The president issues a message. And generally, the message says, we are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of minorities. You are wonderful people. We're all citizens together. Let's live in peace and harmony. That's generally the message, and it's generally why you never hear about it. Well, in 1946, Erev Yom Kippur, President Harry Truman issued a message that was heard. He announced that he endorsed the idea of partition of Palestine into a Jewish and Arab state and urged the immediate admission of 100,000 DPs to Palestine from the displaced persons camps in Europe. The British continued to enforce the white paper. They were not allowing the survivors to come to Palestine. Why does Truman issue this support? Why in November 1947, when the partition vote comes up, November 29th, Kaftet B'November, some of you live near that street, why does Truman overrule the State Department, the Defense Department, who say, do not vote in favor of partition. You will alienate the Arab world. There are so many more of them. We have much more to lose than to gain. I think that there might have been some sympathy. Truman was known to favor the underdog. And he had a close friend who was Jewish, who was pro-Zionist. But I think here there's a confluence of sympathy and interest. Erev Yom Kippur 1946 is October 1946. It's a month before the midterm election, the first electoral test of the new president, Harry Truman, since he became president by accident. It's his first electoral test. Here you have a community of American Jews who are deeply committed. Not only do they vote, but we know what so many of them feel about the Zionist cause by 1946. And on top of that, if they're willing to give $100 million to help the DPs and to help the Yeshuv and Eretz Yisrael, well, a candidate that's going to show himself to be pro-Zionist is likely to get their support as well. And so both for the Soviet Union and for the United States, sympathy may play a role. I don't mean to say it doesn't. I just mean to say it's more complicated than that. It's not only sympathy. It's perceived national or self-interest that plays a role as well. So, the simple belief that sympathy or guilt somehow led to the creation of the Jewish state is far too simplistic. It may have played a role. I don't mean to say it didn't play any role at all. But it simplifies things both in terms of the long run of Jewish history and our attachment to this land, the history of the Zionist movement and the state in the making by 1939, and the self-interest that's involved in national decision-making. Questions up to this point? Yes. I think there is. I think if you read the press and you read what people are writing, there's often a critique of this oversimplified connection that so many people, ironically, the Israeli government, as well as anti-Israel forces, that oversimplistic idea is nonetheless very, very prevalent. And I don't mean, again, I hope everybody understands, I'm not denying the connection. There is a connection, but the connection is a little more convoluted than the way it's usually presented. Yeah, Jonah. Right. Look, first of all, in my own trips that I lead to Poland, I try very hard not to focus only on the Shoah. You know, there are about 900 or 1,000 years of Polish Jewish history to talk about before you get to the Shoah. There's also a lovely, small but growing Polish Jewish community today, which is fascinating. And it's very important for young Jews from other countries to meet with them and to uncover a remarkable phenomenon. What can you say? It's easier to speak in cliches. It's easier to say things simplistically and to try to show the complexity, to me, is actually the most interesting part of history. To see that it's usually not one thing that leads to another. It's usually a confluence of factors, and there are factors pushing forward, factors pushing back. You know, that's the give and take of history. But it's not always the way history is taught. Ask away, Tali. Sure. It's actually the part of the Haredi world views it that way. Zionism and, in general, secularism and falling away from Jewish observance led to the Shoah. Politically, were you speaking politically? I think it's a much harder case to make. You know, the relationship of the Nazis to the Zionists is also not simple. On the one hand, the Nazis were definitely anti-Zionist, and their support of Haj Amin al-Husseini and Palestinian nationalism is the clearest example of that. That's true. And had the British not stopped the Wehrmacht, the German army, at El Alamein in 1942, the German forces would have reached Palestine, and one could only imagine that the fate of the Jews in Palestine at the time would have been the same as the Jews of Europe. And that was a close call. On the other hand, the Nazis and the Zionists actually brokered an agreement. In the 1930s, as German Jews were being persecuted, and many German Jews wanted to leave Germany, and the Zionist movement wanted to encourage those German Jews to leave Germany and come to Palestine, they made what was called the transfer agreement, in which German Jews couldn't take their possessions with them, but they could order German industrial goods and have it delivered in Palestine. So you could order a Volkswagen and have it delivered in Palestine. You could order a German sewing machine and have it delivered to you in Palestine. And in that way, the Nazis facilitated part of the Fifth Aliyah. In a way, you know, this requires a different understanding than many of us have. In a way, this uncovers the fact that the Nazis had not yet decided on the final solution. They were willing to let German Jews go. 60% of German Jews left before the war began. And German Jewry as a community has a much higher, ironically, a much higher survival rate than Polish Jews, for example. Because so many of them were able to leave during the 6 years of Nazi rule from 33 to 39. The Nazis decide on the final solution only in 1941. Up until that point, they're willing to, quote-unquote, get rid of the Jews, not by murder necessarily, but also by expulsion or by letting them leave. So I think it would be it's hard, again, except for the theological Haredi argument, I think it's hard to argue politically that Zionism led to the Shoah. I think for the Germans, first of all, it didn't matter whether you were Zionist or not. Most of the Jews killed in the Shoah were probably not Zionists. The Zionist movement was enormous in Eastern Europe, but that doesn't mean that a majority of the Jews were necessarily Zionists. And secondly, they hardly mention Zionism. They usually talk about it only in the context of their relationship with Haj Amin al-Husseini. But otherwise, when you read how the Nazis talk about the Jews, the word Zionist almost never appears. Jewish Bolsheviks, that appears almost all the time. Jewish parasites. But Zionists, that's a much more recent phenomenon. What? Yeah, Zionism in the Mein Kampf, but, you know, okay. It doesn't take up a tremendous amount of Mein Kampf, nor do you see it in the speeches that Hitler gives afterwards. It appears. Yes, Abigail. Yeah, I think it's the chronological juxtaposition. And, obviously, it's a simple thing. You know, like, political leaders know that you have to have a slogan that's simple for people to understand, right? Keep it simple, stupid, right? You want to have a message? Keep it very simple. Simple means usually simplistic, too. So it's a very simple message to give, and it begs the question because of the chronology, 1945, 1948, that's three very short years. One really happens right after the other. So, you know, it's very easy to make that case. And again, I'm not denying that there is such a case. I'm only saying that it's much more complicated than that. So, and again, I think, you know, there's no question that there is some truth to the idea that, well, let me put it this way. When Israeli political leaders say stupid things, and they often do, like many other political leaders, just hurts more because they're Israeli. When they say stupid things, like if the state of Israel existed, there wouldn't have been a Shoah. I mean, that's preposterous. It's preposterous. But there is some truth to the idea that if there would have been a state of Israel, then people who were trying to escape from Nazism would have had a place to go instead of the closed doors that many of them found in the 30s and in the 40s. So it's, you know, that is true. I think that's historically, you know, it's always the if question, it's always hard to answer. But I think that in that limited way, you know, so instead of 6 million Jews murdered, so it would have been 5 million Jews murdered. Do you know what I mean? 5.5 million. By the way, the number 6 million is not to be taken as holy. Did I mention this the other day? Professor Yehuda Bauer, who is no Holocaust denier, he's the dean of Holocaust historians in Israel today, Hebrew University, Yad Vashem, thinks that the number is probably closer to 5.6 or 5.7 million. The answer is, the truth is, we don't know. We don't know how many Jews were killed in the Shoah. The Germans were very good record keepers, but they didn't record everything. And so when they load people on trains, they didn't always record how many people were being loaded on trains. And when they murdered people by gunfire, they didn't always report exactly how many. In some cases, they did, but not always. So therefore, we don't really know. So that number, if in your lifetime historical researchers say 5.5 million Jews were killed in the Shoah, don't think that's Holocaust denial. It's probably just good historical research. Yeah. Sure. First of all, lots of Sephardi Jews were killed in the Shoah. 90% of Greek Jews were murdered in the Shoah, and the vast majority of them were Sephardim, Jews from the Balkans. Most of them were Sephardim. The Nazis did not distinguish. They were equal opportunity murderers. North Africa is a somewhat different story. The Nazis only occupy North Africa for a relatively short period of time. As I mentioned, they were beaten back from El Alamein, and ultimately Rommel and his Africa Corps are defeated. And therefore, North African Jews suffer under the Nazis, but there isn't the same mass murder that takes place to Sephardi Jews and Ashkenazi Jews in Europe. One of the things that we also have to bear in mind is that in 1939, 90% of the Jews were Ashkenazim. Only 10% of the Jewish world was Sephardim. So relatively speaking, we're talking about a much smaller community than they are today. Because since the primary victims of the Shoah were Ashkenazim, today the Sephardi-Ashkenazi balance is much more real than it was then. Okay? Oh, thank you. I didn't get to that. Yes, there were Zionist movements that began, the modern Zionist movement, built on the traditional Zionism. The modern Zionist movement begins to affect Jews in Arab countries, whether in North Africa or Iraq or Iran or other countries. Iran's not an Arab country. It's a Persian country. But definitely, it comes a little bit later. Again, the traditional Zionism always existed. For example, in 1881, when the first Aliyah begins, there's a wave of Yemenite Jews who come to Israel, or Palestine at the time. And those Yemenite Jews were not coming because they heard about the pogroms in Russia. They're coming for the traditional Zionist reasons. So built on top of that traditional Zionism is the modern Zionism, which by the 1900s, is already impacting Sephardi communities as well, and there are lots of Sephardi immigrants coming to the land of Israel before 1939 and certainly after the state is established from neighboring countries, whether North Africa or in the Middle East. Thank you for asking that question. Yes? Maybe it needed World War II. Yeah, I mean, certainly all of this is connected. Yes. I hear what you're saying. You know, again, the if question in history is always very hard. Had there been no World War II and no Shoah, it's very possible that the Jewish state would have been established before 1948. But that's speculation. Again, because of the state of the making, because of other things, I think that it's hard for us to extrapolate to that. Okay, up until now, yes, last question, Sarah. Absolutely. I think I mentioned that the Soviet support and its satellite support for the partition resolution was key. And they were in favor, even though communist ideology was long against Zionism. But once again, national interest trumps ideology, as it usually does. Ah, okay, good, good. Yes. This is certainly another factor. I'm glad you're raising it. Yes. Did the Soviets think that they could use a new state of Israel within the context of the Cold War? And yes, certainly in Israel, remember, the leadership is socialist. The leadership is even often Russian-speaking. Right? Ben-Gurion and all of those people, they spoke Russian, they were socialists, and they had a certain amount of affinity for the Soviet Union. And in the very beginning, in the early years, the Soviet Union did more than just help with the partition vote. The Soviets allowed the Czechs to send arms that played a critical role in the War of Independence. The Czechs were under Soviet control. They could have prevented that. But the Soviets didn't. And they did hope that in the Cold War, these socialists would be likely partners for them in the Middle East, much more likely partners than medieval monarchs who were ruling over the various Arab states at the time. So yes, absolutely. Okay, I want to change hats and go to the last source, because up until now, I've been speaking as a student of history, and and yet, I want to speak now with a different hat. And I'd like to share with you the Haftorah that we read on Shabbat Chol HaMoed of Pesach, the prophetic portion from the book of Ezekiel. The Lord pressed his hand upon me. This is Ezekiel talking, Yechezkel. He brought me out with his wind and placed me in the valley. It was filled with bones. He made me traverse them all around, and there were many of them all over the valley, and they were very dry. He said to me, Son of man, can these bones be revived? And I said, Lord, O God, you alone know. He said to me, prophesy over these bones. Say to them, O dry bones, listen to the word of the Lord. For so says the Lord God to these bones. Behold, I shall place my spirit within you, and you shall live. I will place sinews upon you, pad you with flesh, and cover you with skin. And I shall place a spirit within you, and you shall live, and you will know that I am the Lord. So I prophesied as I was commanded, and as I prophesied, there was a sound, a rattling noise, and the bones came together, each bone to its bone. And I watched as sinews were placed upon them, and flesh padded them, and skin covered them on the surface, but they were without breath. He said to me, prophesy, son of man, prophesy to the wind. Say to the wind, thus said the Lord God, come wind from all four directions, and breathe into these slain ones so that they might live. And I prophesied as he had commanded me. And the wind breathed into them, and they were alive. And they stood upon their feet, an exceedingly vast army. He said to me, Son of man, these bones are all the house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones have dried. Our hope is lost. Avda tikvatenu. Anybody know where that's from? Naftali Tzvi Inbar took it from here. He says, Lo avda tikvatenu in atikva. But here originally it says, our hope is lost, the bones say. Our decree has been sealed. Therefore prophesy, saying to them, thus spoke the Lord God, behold, I shall open your graves and lift you out of your graves, my people. I shall bring you to the land of Israel. And you will know that I am the Lord when I open your graves and lift you out of your graves, my people. I shall breathe my spirit into you, and you shall live. And I shall place you upon your land, and you will know that I am the Lord. I have spoken and performed, says the Lord. Thank you.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.